Well, I want to say good morning to everybody in this room, everybody joining us in Cafe, everybody at Mountain View, which is celebrating doing their Sunday night services, and in San Mateo, where they're getting ready to do, you're getting ready to do your first Saturday night service this Easter. And San Jose, you are celebrating your 1 month anniversary this week. So way to go for you guys. Also, we actually got a request for a shout out to a growing online little community who follow us in Lincolnshire in the UK. And they didn't think that we would say yes. So can we all say hello, Lincolnshire? Way to go, UK, like Menlo East, so cool. I want to thank the worship team. I don't know how many of you get to see this, but like Pat Little, who is leading this year, actually broke a string on his guitar. Did you see that? Pat is better with five strings than most people are with six. So, like, thanks to all of them. I thought we would start by talking about church etiquette for a minute. It's actually going to set up where this message is going, but we're going to start there. Like, for instance, how should we greet each other in church? How are you supposed to do that? A lot of you will know a woman named Emily Post kind of wrote the Bible on etiquette, and she has extensive advice for greeting people. She wrote this originally in 1922. For example, you may not have known this. According to Emily Post, a gentleman should never initiate shaking hands with a lady. But should he do that, Emily Post wrote, no thoroughbred lady would refuse to shake any hand that is honorable, not even the hand of a coal heaver, at the risk of her fresh white gloves. So if you're a coal heaver here today, you picked the right weekend. I hope you feel really welcome. Except Emily Post had rules about greeting in church. This is what she wrote. People do not greet each other in church, except at a wedding. Hello should not be said on this occasion in church because it's too familiar. Now, I think we can throw out that rule, don't you all think? Because we want this to be a place where everybody's welcome. And that means we have to figure out some etiquette issues for decisions that didn't even exist in 1922. For example, sometimes people leave their cell phone on ring mode during a church service. How do we all feel about that? No, not a good idea. My old church had a rule, if somebody's phone went off during a service, they had to order pizza for everybody at church that day. Or, in some churches, a guest will ask a longtime attender for directions to some areas like children's ministries, and the longtimer will just point, it's over there. How do we feel about that? No way. We say, I will go with you. I'll take you there myself. Or sometimes during worship, during a sermon, I'm told people will actually be checking out their Facebook page. How do we feel about that? No way. Not a good idea. Violates our etiquette. Or it's a true story. Guy at church said there was a couple making out in the balcony during a service. Making out during a service. How do we feel about that? No. No, not this. No. Some of you are thinking, I feel like I got to go check out the balcony. Not a good idea. Now, the reason I bring this up is one day Jesus decided to introduce a whole new etiquette to worship in his day. And this one teaching rocked people's world, still does. It actually got incorporated into the 12 steps, and it's going to rock lives today. For some folks, right here, it's going to lead to conversations that will be super hard and unbelievably liberating. So, this is from the Sermon on the Mount in the fifth chapter of the Gospel of Matthew. Jesus is teaching. Let's say that you've come to worship God and you have a gift to bring him and you're approaching the altar. This is a holy moment. This is super important. But while you're doing that, you happen to remember a relationship in your life that's kind of broken. You've said something or done something to another person and it's not resolved. What should you do? Now, rabbis in Jesus' day used to debate about this. They would debate, if you have begun one duty, when is it ever right to interrupt that and do something else? And they said the only time is if there's a higher and more important duty that you've been neglecting. Now, of course, worshiping God was incredibly important. So we would expect Jesus to say, you know, if that happens to you, first complete your act of devotion to God, and then go be reconciled to that person because God is more important than any human being. But Jesus doesn't say that. In fact, he says the opposite. He says, I want you to interrupt your worship. I want you to leave your gift. I want you to leave the altar. I want you to leave the church. Get out of there and go and deal with that relationship. Jesus says that for God, people come first. For God, relationships, treating people right, actually comes first. That's how important it is. In other words, if I knowingly allow an unreconciled relationship to just linger, if I indulge that, if there are amends that I could have made but I have not made, and then I go to church and I sing songs and I read the Bible and I give gifts and I worship while I'm blowing off somebody I've damaged, I am not pleasing God, I am dishonoring God. And it made me wonder when I thought about this passage, when Jesus was teaching this, because he was dead serious, I wonder if people got up while he was talking. I wonder, while Jesus was talking, if somebody said, man, I got a brother and things are not right between me and him. I got to go talk. There's somebody I cheated. I got to go set things right. There's somebody I got anger problems towards and I got to go apologize. I'll bet that happened. And I'll bet when it happened, Jesus didn't say, hey, where are you going? I'm talking. I'll bet he said, way to go. Way to go. We're going to cheer you on. And by the way, right now during this sermon, I'm real serious about this because we're about doing what Jesus said. If you feel that pang, if God brings this memory to your mind, if you get a little convicted and you think I've done something, I've said something, I've wronged somebody, and you do what Jesus said and you get up and you leave this room and go to obey Jesus' command and walk out during this sermon, that's okay. In fact, if that happens and our hearts are right, everybody around you will cheer you on, because around here, nobody's perfect, because when it comes to broken relationships and hurting people, me too. We're in this series called Unstuck, and we've been learning from the 12 steps, which actually were acquired from the Bible, primarily Jesus' life and teaching, and we've been walking through them 1 week at a time. We admit that our life is unmanageable. My ego, my sin are out of my control. And then we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And then let go, surrendered our lives and our wills to the care of God. We're working on this week by week. Did a fearless and searching moral inventory. That was kind of scary. And then didn't stop there, but confessed to God, myself, and one other human being. That takes courage. The exact nature of our wrongs. And I want to say, if you've done that, if you've been doing that, way to go. That's the way of Jesus. That's life. And this weekend is built on that foundation. It's one step at a time. But I got to tell you, the step we talk about this weekend is really powerful. And it combines a couple of them out of the 12 steps. I'll put it like this. We made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them, all, and made amends wherever possible. Made a list of all persons we'd harm, became willing to make amends to them all, and made amends wherever possible. This is tough. To speak personally, before we started this series, the other steps up till now I had done before, not perfectly by a long shot, but real intentionally. I'd never done this one. I'd done it on a case-by-case basis as it occurred to me, but never like systematically, comprehensively done this. And I'll just tell you, this one takes time. This one is really hard. I hate this one. And I love this one. So I've started it. I'm committed to it. I'm accountable to a fully disclosing friend in my life for it. But it's going to take a while to do. And as I said, like all the steps, we draw this from the Bible, especially from the life and teachings of Jesus. So in the time that's left in this talk, I want to look at one person that Jesus transformed by the name of Zacchaeus and this step of making amends. A guy named Ken Bailey, who wrote wonderfully on this passage, notes that this story of Zacchaeus is so loaded with the kind of dynamics that make the amends step really hard, but also really freeing. So I want to walk through this story, look at Zacchaeus making amends, and then it's going to be my turn, and it's going to be your turn. So we're all going to pay a lot of attention to this story today, right? Even those of us in the balcony, right? Here we go. This is from Luke chapter 19. Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through. Now, this detail will come back later. Luke deliberately lets us know that Jesus is passing through. In other words, he's not going to stay in Jericho, which means everybody in town would be quite disappointed. Because in ancient times, when a rabbi came to town, a famous rabbi, he was a big celebrity, people would get all excited. In our day, if the president comes to the Bay Area, say for a fundraiser, do people get all excited? No, not so much. They're going to close down the airport and there's traffic jams and people get ticked off because we have better things to do. But in the ancient world, people didn't have better things to do. There was just nothing much to do. There was no Netflix. There were no Pilates classes. There was no March Madness. There was nothing to do. So when some big rabbi would come to town like Jesus, he drew huge crowds. He would heal the sick. He would feed the hungry. He would bless little children. And a town like Jericho would carefully select the person who was going to host this visiting rabbi. They didn't have many hotels back in that day, so they would choose someone who would reflect honor on their village. But then Jesus comes and they find out he's not going to stay. He's not going to heal their sick. He's not going to bless their children. He's not going to feed their hungry. They feel a little disrespected. A man was there named Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was wealthy. He wanted to see who Jesus was. But because he was short, he could not see over the crowd. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore fig tree to see him, since Jesus was coming that way. Now, honestly, tax collectors have probably never been loved in any countries. Mark Twain asked one time, what's the difference between a taxidermist and a tax collector? Have you all heard this? The taxidermist takes only your skin. That's what Mark Twain said. In ancient Israel, they were particularly despised. And the way this worked, some of you will know about this, the way you got a franchise to be tax collector for a particular region was you would bid out a contract with the government to pay a certain amount of money for that region, and the highest bidder would get the contract. And then whatever you could collect over that amount that you had to pay the government, you got to keep. So it's a system that, you know, reinforced corruption. And tax collectors were notoriously dishonest. This is so true. I'm not making this up. One village actually built a statue to an honest tax collector because they were so rare. Worse, the taxes didn't go to pay the government of Israel. They went to pay the government of Rome. Rome was oppressing Israel. So tax collectors were viewed not only as corrupt, but as traitors. Traitors to God, traitors to God's people. Some rabbis actually taught this, that you were allowed to lie to a tax collector. That it was okay with God if you lied to a tax collector. In case you're wondering, that's not in the Bible, so don't try that at home. But some rabbis taught that in Jesus' day. Tax collectors were regarded as unclean, so you couldn't touch one or you'd be unclean. You couldn't go to their home. You couldn't eat a meal with them, or you would take on their uncleanness. Etiquette was real clear. This is why in the New Testament, you constantly see two different categories of people associated with each other. Like the Pharisees said to Jesus' disciples, why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? Or Luke 15 says, now the tax collectors and sinners were gathering around to hear Jesus. Why always those two categories? Now, of course, Israel knew everybody sinned, but sinners was kind of a technical word to describe people that deliberately and flagrantly violated God's law. In some places, it gets more specific. Jesus teaching one time the religious leaders, and he says, the tax collectors and prostitutes are entering the kingdom of God ahead of you. How dicey do you think things got in that moment? Jesus got enormous courage. Now, Zacchaeus is a tax collector, not just a tax collector. He's chief tax collector. It means he's wealthy. He's got minions working for him. People hate him. People wish he would die. But he wanted to see Jesus. Why would he, a tax collector, want to see Jesus? Well, he's heard these strange stories about this Jesus having kind of a soft spot in his heart for tax collectors. Jesus would eat with tax collectors. Jesus would hang out with, he would actually go to parties. One of his followers is actually a tax collector. Jesus wears this T-shirt. I love tax collectors. And so Zacchaeus, who is a tax collector, decides he wants to see this rabbi. But Zacchaeus is vertically challenged. He knows if he's in a crowd, he can't see over the people, and they're never going to make way for him. So Luke says he runs ahead of the crowd. Now, that's a little undignified for a wealthy, powerful man in ancient Near Eastern culture. Then he climbs up a tree. Now, that's a lot undignified for a wealthy, powerful guy. Luke tells us it's a sycamore fig tree. He tells us that for three reasons. For one thing, they had real low branches, easy for a short guy to climb. For another thing, they got big leaves. That's handy for an unliked guy to hide. But then also, sycamore trees had to be grown. There was an instruction in what's called the Mishnah, ancient instructions, that said a sycamore tree has to be grown at least 50 cubits outside of a village. So the idea here is Zacchaeus wants to see Jesus without anybody seeing Jesus. So he goes outside the village to this tree, climbs up it, but no luck. Jesus gets to the tree and the crowd is still with Jesus. Jesus actually calls Zacchaeus by name. Now, how does Zacchaeus know Jesus? How does Jesus know Zacchaeus' name? Because he didn't live in Jericho. Well, it could be miraculous knowledge, but Ken Bailey says the most likely scenario is this. The crowd follows with Jesus out of town, and somebody sees Zacchaeus up the tree. Now, this is a humiliating moment for Zacchaeus. And this is the crowd's chance. You know, people cannot insult Zacchaeus to his face in town. He could tax him to death. But from the crowd, anonymously, they could let him have it. And they do. And Zacchaeus is humiliated. They're taunting him. Jesus sees what's going on, and he opens his mouth to speak. This is a real amazing moment. And the crowd waits, and they know what Jesus is going to say because he's a prophet. He's going to say, Zacchaeus, you have betrayed your God and you have betrayed these people. You clean up your act. You repent. You straighten out your life. There's no place in Jericho for somebody like you. There would be massive applause for a speech like that. Jesus doesn't make a speech like that. Jesus looked up into that tree and said, Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today. So Zacchaeus came down and once welcomed him with joy. It's probably the first time Zacchaeus has felt any joy in a lot of years, but nobody watching is feeling any joy. When I was a kid, we used to sing a song in Sunday school. Nobody here will be old enough to remember it. Zacchaeus was a wee little man. A wee little man was he. Climbed up in a sycamore tree. Nobody in the crowd is singing a song about wee little Zacchaeus. What they're saying is, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? The worst scum in town, and now Jesus is going to stay in Jericho? At his house? Are you kidding me? All the people saw this and began to mutter, he, Jesus, has gone to be the guest of a sinner. Jesus is taking the condemnation that had been directed to Zacchaeus justly on himself. Jesus is saying to this tax collector, to this sinner, to this hated, traitorous thief, I will sit at your table. I will sleep on your guest bed. I will eat from your chair. I will put myself in your place. Jesus, the perfect rabbi, is taking the uncleanness of a sinner on himself for the sake of love. Now, this is a little foretaste of the cross. And apparently they go to Zacchaeus' home. Most likely they're having dinner in a courtyard area where folks could watch, because in those days, dinners at the homes of the wealthy were kind of public events. And now Zacchaeus starts to churn, because he looks and there's Jesus in his home. Jesus is eating and laughing and blessing and teaching like somebody bringing light into a dark place. But there's the crowd, and the crowd's real ugly. And he sees this crowd rejecting Jesus, who accepted him. And not just that, Zacchaeus sees a widow, and she has no place to live because he took her farm. He sees a couple little orphan kids, and they're beggars in the streets because he took their inheritance. He sees a man that used to have a little shop that used to be a merchant, but Zacchaeus robbed him of it. And that man had a son who was so embittered, he rebelled against Rome, and the Romans killed his son, and now he's got no business, and he's got no son, and it's Zacchaeus' fault. Now that he's with Jesus, everything looks different to him. When Jesus comes into your life, You look at people differently, see. And in a very dramatic moment, he rises from the table. If you've ever been at a kind of a formal meal and somebody stands up to make a little speech, that's a big deal. And everybody stops to hear what this hated traitor thief is going to say. But Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, to Jesus, "Look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor, and if I have cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount." There's a moment of stunned silence. And Mrs. Zacchaeus is thinking, "Hey, honey, shouldn't we talk about this first?" And the crowd goes wild. "Man, I thought hearing that Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead was something. But an honest tax collector? Are you kidding me? This is the biggest miracle of all." And you understand what this means for Jericho. No more shaking down widows. No more robbing little orphans. No more squeezing peasants. Jesus has brought justice to Jericho. When the good news comes to a tax collector, it's good news for everybody. When the gospel comes to a rich guy, it's gospel, it's good news all around. Now imagine that Zacchaeus skipped this step. Imagine, because sometimes in church we think this way. Imagine Zacchaeus stood up and said, "I used to be a sinner, but Jesus has forgiven me. I'm so glad. Sure, sorry for all that money I stole. My bad. Of course, I spent it all, so there's nothing I can do about it now. But fortunately, because of grace, I don't have to." See, grace is not permission to not do what's right. Grace is the power to do what's right. And that's part of the journey we're on with our friend Jesus. So let's look at how we do this stuff. I want to get very concrete now. We actually have a worksheet, and Sue Kim On from our staff put this together, and you can access this online or get a hard copy of it and take it with you today, and we're all going to do this. And I just want to walk through this real concretely. The first thing I do is I actually make a list of the people that I have wronged. I actually begin by making a list. It's part of what I have been doing. Now imagine what Zacchaeus' list looked like. Do you think it was long? It was like everybody in Jericho, and that can be really daunting. I get it. People before you have done this. And Zacchaeus actually went public so that he would be accountable with his intention on this, so it wouldn't be just an emotional moment with Jesus. He actually declared his intention to other folks. "I'm going to set things right." So I'll tell you how I've started on this one. I begin by just making a list of the people in my life, and I wrote down several dozen. I'll show you just the first little batch: my dad, my mom, my brother, my sister, my wife, and our three children. And then in the next column, I ask, have I ever done or said anything that might have hurt or harmed them? Have I ever been deceitful or stubborn or defensive or selfish or greedy or judgmental ever? And I just go through a column with my dad, no, my mom, no, brother, no, sister, no, Nancy, maybe a little one time, kids, no, that column looks a lot bloodier than that. And I got to get honest here. That might help you to have kind of categories of people: family, friends, coworkers, neighbors, folks in your financial life, people here in this church. I know, this hurts. I know, guys. And then second step, what is the harm I've caused? What is the harm I've caused in these people's lives? It will help to be as specific as possible. There's a tiny example. It's just recent. Nancy and I had been cleaning a bunch of stuff out of the garage, and Nancy had one box of stuff that was too big to go in our garbage can. I was gone that afternoon, so she left it leaning against my car where I could take care of it. And then she was gone for a couple of days. And when she got back, the box was still outside, now leaning against the garage. And she asked me about it. How come the box is still there? And I said, oh, I didn't realize that that was the plan. I didn't realize that you intended me to haul it off somewhere. And then I thought, so what am I saying to her? Did I think that the box fairy came and just tilted this big box against my car for no reason at all? And I had to go back and say, the truth is, I just deceived you. I just didn't want to do anything with that box. And then I think through, this is the key part of this step. Then I think through, how does deceiving harm her? How does it harm her? And it does that by eroding her trust in a relationship where trust is important and owed. And what that means is I will make her either a little more gullible person, if she trusts me, or a little more bitter and suspicious if she doesn't. See, I have harmed her. I have caused her to move from God's good for her. So often, I might just think, well, I was deceptive, but I don't think about how did I harm this person. This is a great problem. If you deceive me or steal from me or gossip about me, I know exactly how you have harmed me. But if I deceive you, I don't think about how I have harmed you. Goofy little story, but it kind of illustrates the point. A mom has a 7-year-old named Billy and a baby in the other room, and there's this scream, and the mom says, "What was that?" And Billy says, "The baby pulled my hair. It hurt. I'm so mad." And the mom said, "Well, the baby doesn't know how much it hurts." A few seconds later, there's another scream. "What was that?" Billy says, "Now the baby knows." See, a major reason I keep hurting people is I avoid thinking about the harm that I'm doing to them. And in this step, I deliberately ask God to help me think about what I normally avoid thinking about. Now the baby knows. Now the baby knows. Now, why do I do this? Paul says, this is so amazing to understand love. We've been talking about that over the last year. Love does no harm. Love does no harm to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of all the law. There's a, you know, books in that statement. The law is all about love, to will the good as God intends good for the other person, and that's what love does. Next step, am I willing to make amends? Am I willing? Now, it's a private deal between me and God, you and God, and God's talking to some of you about this right now. In every case with each person, I just honestly write down, yes, I'm willing, or no, actually right now, God, I'm not. Honesty is what's key. This is way back in the Bible. Any man or woman who wrongs another in any way and so is unfaithful to the Lord is guilty and must confess the sin they have committed. They must make full restitution for the wrong they have done and add a fifth of the value to it. Now, Zacchaeus goes beyond that and give it all to the person they have wronged. You see how in the Bible, making amends flows right out of the other steps. I do a searching and fearless moral inventory. I admit to God, myself, and one other the exact nature of my wrongs, and then I make amends. And this will raise a whole bunch of questions. What if it would cost too much? What if the other person doesn't deserve it? What if I would be embarrassed? What if it would damage my reputation? God wouldn't want that. What if my spouse has hurt me way more than I've hurt my spouse? What if I have stolen from work and I might go to jail? See, gang, this is only for people whose lives have become unmanageable and who have therefore surrendered their lives and their will to the care of God. So they're not worried about their lives anymore. If you haven't taken that step, you know, this step's not going to make any sense. But that's where you begin to live in the kingdom, in the presence and power and care and transforming strength of God. So I'll make a list, names, have I harmed them? Am I willing to make amends? I want to mention here one other step that can be really helpful. In this process, talk to a wise, trusted, confidential Christian brother or sister about making amends before you go to the one that you've harmed. There are some times when you need not to go to that person. For example, maybe there's somebody that has physically harmed you, and if you went to them, you would place yourself in physical danger. That wouldn't be good for you. It wouldn't be good for them. So in that case, you would need not to go to them. There will be maybe some exceptions, but they'll be quite rare. And I'll need a wise, trusted, confidential Christian brother or sister to go through this. And then the next step, I go to the other person, I ask for forgiveness, and I offer to make things right. I confess my action. I confess my wrong heart, my wrong motive. I don't explain. I don't try to make it sound any better. I don't say, but look at what you did to me. I don't say, look at what else was going on in my life that caused me to do this. Folks wonder, but what if that other person doesn't accept my apology? That's not up to you. Your job is to confess and make amends. You'll be surprised how often a heart melts, but that's not your job. What if I tried it before and it didn't work? Try it again. You know, God's real patient with me. Relationships are usually not broken overnight. They usually don't get healed overnight, but we get this kind of microwave. Man, I tried doing the right thing one time. Didn't work. God didn't work. I told you I made a list. There was a relationship where I had been judgmental and withdrawing and gossipy and so, and I realized it's got to stop. So I made a phone call. That was a really hard call to make, and we talked, and then we had another phone conversation, and then we met face-to-face, and it was a couple of hours, and I talked to this guy about, you know, what have I done and how has it hurt? And it's not over yet, but I am so glad I'm on that path. Zacchaeus gets on that path. Here and now. Giving away half of my stuff. I want to make amends to anybody I ever cheated. I'm going public. And Jesus looked at Zacchaeus and he didn't say, oh man, Zacchaeus, don't do that. He didn't say, oh Zacchaeus, it's going to cost you too much money. He said, today salvation has come to this house. And I want to tell you, salvation still comes. I got an email this week from a man who got saved out of the Haight-Ashbury district in the 60s. Anybody know what was going on in Haight-Ashbury in the 60s? A lot of substance issues going on for this guy. He got saved, got married, got a family, went to seminary, went into ministry, helped to start a church. And then he was at a wedding reception and somebody offered him a glass of champagne, one glass, and he took it. And then just hell. Lost his marriage, lost his family, lost his ministry. And guys, I want to say, you know, this series is not just for a subset of folks called addicts. We're all addicted to sin. We're all trapped. We're all stuck. But man, I just keep hearing stories. I know when an addiction like that gets its grips on you and people try to cope and they try to manage it by themselves, they try to white knuckle it, don't do that. And they lose marriages. This guy found the way of Jesus through the 12 steps. And he wrote me and said, I'm following you guys every week. I'm writing these words with tears in my eyes. I hope everybody can learn now what I wish I'd known then. Salvation came to his house. I talked to a guy a couple weeks ago right here at our church, not from a religious background at all, never believed in God, but he graduated from school and a woman who had been a classmate of his tracked him down when she didn't have to apologize and set right a wrong that she had committed earlier. And she did it because she's a follower of Jesus, and it intrigued him so much that he has now come into our church every week to check out a Jesus who would prompt such behavior in another human life. Salvation is gonna come to his house. I was working on this message this week, and somebody was outside my door. They wanted to come in and meet, and quite honestly, I thought, God, I'm working on this sermon. I'm trying to think up ways to talk about making amends, and I don't have time for this meeting. And then this person came in and sat down and just started to cry, said, God has led me to make a list of people that I've wronged and make amends, and I've been writing letters, and I've had people that I've wronged that I hadn't seen for years suddenly show up in my life so I can take this step. And I've been having conversations I never thought that I would have. And I feel like my heart was in chains for years, and those chains are just bursting. God is changing me so much, I can't believe it. And now this person wants to get baptized. And this Easter, we're going to be doing baptisms at every campus. Baptism, kind of like the 13th step. You know, there's the 12 steps, and then baptism is the way that you express what Zacchaeus did. I have welcomed Jesus to my house. I welcomed him to my life, even though I didn't deserve it. And I want everybody to know. And God might be calling you to do that this year, this Easter, somebody that you know. Be praying like crazy about that, because salvation still comes. Jesus still comes. He says to people, you come on down. And people come down, and he changes their life, and the crowd goes wild. Still happens. So, now the only question is, will you do this? Will you do this? And here's what we're going to do. We're going to end this service quite abruptly, very intentionally, this weekend. Normally, after the sermon, there's a song or something, and then there's a benediction, and everybody kind of knows we're done. We're not going to do that. We're going to end this real abruptly this week. I was on a Southwest flight not too long ago, and after the wheels came down, the flight attendant came on and said, "We landed. Get out." And that was the most memorable exit from a plane I can remember in a long time. We're going to end quite abruptly. Here's why. Because Jesus said, if you think of somebody that you know, this relationship is broken, you have done something, you have said something, there's something wrong, for God's sake, don't blow it off. I don't care how much it costs you. I don't care how hard it is. I don't care if you have done it before. God will go with you. God is in this. People have been doing this ever since Zacchaeus and way before. Some of you, this is your day. I'm dead serious about this. Jesus is dead serious about this. There is power and life on the other side. So get out your cell phone. Like right now, there's somebody, there's a call you got to make. There's a list that you got to start writing down. There's a letter that you got to craft. There's a prayer that you got to pray. God, I'm not willing right now. Help me to be willing. There is something you got to do. We do not want to be one of those churches where people go away and say, well, that was a good talk, or that wasn't a good talk. We want to be one of those churches where people say, I will do what he said. We landed. Get out.